This is Alaskan Legislative Review, a program of analysis of legislative issues by members of the faculty and staff at the University of Alaska at Fairbanks. I'm your host and producer, Scott Sterling. This program will cover Alaskan residency issues, and our guest today is Dr. Gerald McBeth, chair of the Political Science Department. Before we meet our guest, I'd like to briefly introduce our topic for today. The topic for today's program is Alaskan residency and the issues that are raised by residency requirements in light of the recent United States Supreme Court decision in the Zobel case. Residency issues are important in Alaska today because of rising oil revenues and the number of state benefits that are being distributed because of those revenues. Today we're going to try and discuss the legal and constitutional background behind residency requirements. Jerry, in the concept of residency requirements, what is the purpose behind residency requirements?
Well, there are several purposes by residency requirements, and it depends on whether you're talking about the federal level or the state level. But if we generalize and talk about all state systems, then they tend to separate between members of the state and non-members, and they tend to require certain evidence of membership in the state. And the usual criterion that is used is length of time one has lived in that place without leaving it for a long period of time. And the purpose served by this distinction is to ensure that not everybody is protected who is not affiliated with the place, and to have some basis to use in assigning benefits, giving benefits and protection to individuals. Now, at the federal level and the state level, over the last 100 years, there's been a great deal of change in what residency means. Formerly, it meant citizenship in the place. Increasingly, there's been an erosion of the difference between the citizen and the non-resident or the resident alien, so that currently we talk generally about members of the community as residents in it, whether they happen to be citizens or not citizens. In other words, we've erased this distinction over time for all but the most, political act, I guess, the act of voting.
All right. Is that purpose served by requirements and constitutions as to your length of residency in order to run for office, for example? Is that one of the purposes behind it?
Well, perhaps I should backtrack a bit and say that when the federal constitution was written, the assumption was that citizenship and residency matters would be decided at the state level. Except for federal offices, and for federal offices, special requirements of residency would be made. Unless we have a requirement that the president be a natural born citizen of the United States, and that those running for office in the House and the Senate have established minimum periods of residence in the jurisdiction from which they come. States then were left with the issue of how they should go about allocating citizenship or residency in their state. And some of them required long years of residence before a citizen could vote. All required that members of the state assembly or state legislature have lived in the state for a certain period of time, and that state offices, such as the governorship, be held by individuals who were either native residents of that state or had been there in a somewhat longer period of time. This pattern of letting the states determine residence requirements was judged by the Supreme Court to be unconstitutional in a series of decisions made in the 1960s. Two of these that are most important are Baker versus Carr in 62 and Wesbury versus Sanders in 1964. And what these decisions said, essentially, was that states could establish a minimum period of residency in the state for purposes of voting in that state, but that the state had to demonstrate some reason, some purpose being served in a period of residence that was longer than basically 30 days. And after that point, then states throughout the United States adjusted their residency requirements. They did leave intact, however, special requirements, that is, those running for political offices in the state still are required to live in that state for a period longer than 30 days in most of the 50 states.
Okay. Could we move to the United States Constitution? How does the U.S. Constitution address residency?
The American Constitution addresses the issue of residency is in terms of two jurisdictions. One is a resident of a state of the United States and of the United States itself. And the federal constitution does not allow states to exclude individuals from residency in a given state. And the reason behind this is that for a state to exclude individuals from residency denies that individual the freedom of travel, which is a basic freedom that predates the Constitution. So that then when the Supreme Court or when Congress look at the issue of residency in the various states, the question that they ask is the state of Alaska or Montana or New York denying admittance to that state and thus infringing on citizens' rights to travel in the residency requirements that it sets up.
What about the Alaska Constitution? Does it speak to residency in any significant way?
It declares residency, and there's a 30-day residency requirement for voting in the state. The Constitution, other than this, has relatively little to say about residency.
Other than it establishes minimum requirements as to age and residency for people who desire to serve in public office.
Yes. I would say that the state constitution tends not to differ substantially from most state constitutions as far as residency is concerned.
Okay.
And I would say that the issue in Alaska has been one since the constitution, since 1959. Basically, the issue of residency in Alaska has developed from 1970 to the present. And it's primarily a consequence of the state's oil wealth, with the development of huge resources and the question of how to distribute these among the population of the state in such a way that they advance purposes as seen by the state legislature.
There's a clause in the United States Constitution known as the Equal Protection Clause, which has some bearing on residency and the constitutionality of establishing residency requirements. Could you tell us something about what the Equal Protection Clause means and how it might apply in the case of Alaska?
Well, the Equal Protection Clause comes from the 14th Amendment to the Constitution, which was one of the three post-Civil War amendments to the federal Constitution. And it was put in for the purpose of ensuring that individual rights would be guaranteed against infringements on the part of state governments. Formerly, there had been no question about guarantees of individual citizen rights on the part of the federal Constitution. These were protected through the first 10 amendments. But what the Civil War indicated, and the whole treatment of American minority populations, particularly and primarily the black population, was that states could legally discriminate because they seemed not to have been covered by the first 10 amendments to the Constitution. The Equal Protection Clause then incorporated the first 10 amendments so far as individuals and the relations with states were concerned. So that then in future, any future occasion when an individual felt he was subject to state discrimination, he could apply for federal protection against the state government and the state government's actions. The 14th Amendment has had a substantial influence on state-citizen relations throughout the United States, and especially in the last 20 years. Now, what it means, I guess, to sum up and to state it most simply, is that the state governments must afford all citizens in the state equal protection of the laws, and that this does not imply that they may not discriminate. But if they do discriminate in terms of the benefits, services, and protections, they must do so in a way that furthers the legitimate purpose of the state.
So it's very important to understand what the definition of a legitimate state purpose might be. If one is to understand why distinctions are being made as to different kinds of requirements for residency.
Yes, I think it is. And it means that when state legislatures and state administrations act, they have to be able to demonstrate and to give evidence that what they propose is linked to a purpose of the state. And there are many ways to do this. The problem in the state of Alaska is that the legislature's actions in the past haven't been clearly and directly related to legitimate state purposes.
There's also another clause in the United States Constitution known as the Privileges and Immunities Clause. And that clause, as we'll get to in a little while, seems to have a lot of bearing in the Zobel decision. Could you explain to the audience a little bit about the Privileges and Immunities Clause and its bearing on residency?
Well, the Privileges and Immunities Clause is from Article 4 of the Federal Constitution. And what it says is that states will not deny individuals from other states the full privileges and immunities of that state's citizenship when they come into the state. So, for example, if a person from Arkansas or Texas comes into Alaska, he may not be denied the privileges of Alaska citizenship or the immunities of Alaska citizenship once he has met the state's basic residency requirement, which means 30 days. In other words, he may vote within that period of time. He may be protected under the laws. He may be given benefits of Alaska law. If there are state income assistance benefits, for instance, he must be provided these along with old-term residents of the state. And the purpose behind the Equal Privileges and Immunities Clause is to make it possible for individuals to move from one part of the country to another. The intent of the Founding Fathers of the Constitution was that there would be one nation and not 13, 50, or 100 different nations, and that it was imperative then that states not erect obstacles to free movement of individual citizens from one state to another.
And this also had bearing on the tendency of the early colonies to want to erect tariffs and complicate trade matters among colonies.
Most definitely, and it's tied into the Commerce Clause.
Okay. So, in summation, the United States Constitution has clauses in it which are designed to ensure that citizens of the individual states may freely travel among the other states, and that they are free to be, that they are guaranteed to be treated equally by states that they migrate to, that they are not treated differently just because they have moved to one state from another.
I think that puts it well. In other words, Alaska is constitutionally prohibited from setting up a class of citizens called Pioneer Alaskans, who are different from Alaskans who have been here 5 years, Alaskans 10-year residents, and Alaskans 15-year residents, or classes of Alaskans called California Alaskans, New York Alaskans, Seattle Alaskans, and the like.
I think that's a good overview. Of course, most of us are familiar with the Zobel decision, which was a case which was settled by the United States Supreme Court last year. And the Zobel case gained a lot of notoriety and attention because it directed itself specifically to a state program which was trying to distribute a kind of benefit to people and create distinctions among Alaska residents so that it determined how much money they received. And we're speaking of the permanent fund dividend law. Could you talk about the Zobel case in a general sense and explain the background of why this case finally found itself in the United States Supreme Court?
There's several ways to look at it. I would say that when the problem on the part of the state legislature was how to deal with the vast revenue surpluses that Alaska had, and the great oil wealth that the state would have, but have for a very short period of time, and how to distribute this best. And there were several suggestions. And the legislature recommended and voters approved the creation of the permanent fund as one way of dealing with the wealth management problem and attempting to provide for Alaska's future, and also provided that a certain percentage of permanent fund income would be distributed. Now, the dividend distribution plan was regarded as the most satisfactory that the legislature could come up with because it appeared to distribute wealth evenly throughout the state, and it also appeared to avoid what many legislators feared, that is, the erection of costly government programs and structures which would last on forever. There were objections, however, to the program at the time. The strongest objection was that on the part of individuals who had come to the state recently and who saw that under the distribution scheme they would get less than individuals who had been here since 1959. The legislature created this program with the idea in mind that those who had been in the state longest had given the state the greatest benefits, and that this was one way of then providing for them, providing for the years when state programs benefiting them were relatively few. The objection, however, was that this seemed to set up several classes of citizens in the state of Alaska, and I've talked about these before, and it also seemed questionable, logically, whether individuals simply because they had lived in the state of Alaska, had contributed to a state purpose, mm-hmm. had legitimately advanced state needs, just because they had sat in Alaska, lived in Fairbanks or Anchorage for 25 years. Well, for these and a series of reasons, then, there were questions about the dividend distribution scheme, and the Zobels Anchorage lawyers challenged it. They challenged it as to its constitutionality. A court decision, a lower court decision in Alaska, said that it was an unconstitutional way to distribute benefits throughout the state. And so the issue came to the state Supreme Court, where there was a divided decision. The Supreme Court upheld the legislature's plan, and they said that the plan was justifiable for three reasons. And the most important reason, they said, was they advanced the argument that individuals living in the state a longer period of time have made a stronger contribution to the state's development, and thus should get a greater benefit than individuals who had arrived in the state recently. Further, they implied that individuals, no individual would be discriminated against in the sense of being denied benefits, but there would be a differential rate or structure to the benefits, with those having been in the state longest getting the most. The Zobos appealed this decision to the federal Supreme Court, which considered it over a year and decided last July, and reversed the state Supreme Court's decision. The state Supreme Court's decision was divided. The federal court decision was almost unanimous. There was only one dissenter, and that was William Rehnquist. The reasons that the federal Supreme Court gave for reversing the Zobel decision aren't easy to reduce to one single point. In other words, there were three separate opinions written by the court, and this has been an increasing tendency of the court, especially the Berger Court, which is a relatively divided one. The major decision, joined in by a majority of justices, was that the state's dividend distribution scheme violated the 14th Amendment and its Equal Protection Clause. And there was a second opinion written by Brennan that said that this state distribution scheme violated the Equal Privileges and Immunities Clause. And there was a third opinion written by Justice O'Connor that said that the basic problem with the scheme was that it violated the fundamental right of travel, and tried then to link this to several other points. So that there were at least three points raised in the Zobel issue. But the one that that affects state programs most directly, and is revealed, I guess, in the Zobel decision, and has to be kept uppermost in minds of legislators, I think, is the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution. Then there's various language in the court's opinion that shows, that gives guidance about the ways in which the state can set up programs that we can use. And what this reduces to is, the state, there are legitimate state interests that can be advanced through legislation that enable a state to discriminate. For example, the states are expected to be different, and a state, for the purpose of making itself richer, can set up certain programs that advance that particular interest. The state can decide that it wants to make its citizens smarter, and for that purpose can set up certain programs that also benefit some classes of citizens over other classes of citizens. These are examples of ways the court has said that states can discriminate in the development and delivery of programs to citizens that don't violate the 14th Amendment.
So programs such as discriminating between residents and non-residents in hunting and fishing rights, or paying tuition at public universities, those are recognized as legitimate state interests by the court, and therefore the state is allowed to make the distinction.
I wish there were a clear and simple answer to that. States can certainly discriminate between residents and non-residents so far as hunting is concerned. In other words, the state of Alaska currently charges non-resident hunters much higher fees for licenses than it does residents. And this is a practice that is almost universal throughout the United States. However, the state cannot make it impossible for non-residents to hunt in the state. In other words, it cannot set up an exorbitant fee for non-resident hunters, because this would violate the freedom of hunters of other states to come to Alaska and to hunt. Similarly, the state can discriminate between non-resident and resident students, as most states do in the structure of their tuition at state universities. It cannot, however, make it impossible through this structure of fees for non-residents to come to Alaska to go to school.
So this is the basis the basis by which states may discriminate has to be very specific and very particular as to how it is being done and why. The state cannot make a generalized requirement that students from another state must pay an exorbitant amount of money to come to school here. Does that imply that there is a dividing line between residency and non-residency that the legislature could establish that they could base on some kind of financial requirement? That where would that dividing line fall if you were the legislature and you wanted to cut down on the number of residents non-residents who wish to attend the University of Alaska, for example? How could they, can they try to reduce the amount of non-residents who wish to attend by saying your fees will be so high that we expect it will deter people from coming here?
Well, that's asking the question a little differently, and that's an important point, it seems, that it's very difficult for the state to take as a cardinal principle of legislation the restriction of benefits to outsiders. But that's not a legitimate state purpose.
Mm-hmm.
It is a legitimate state purpose to educate the citizens of that state, and in the process of providing for their education, to establish a fee structure for expensive things like universities, and to further differentiate in that fee structure between those who are residents of the state and those who are non-residents. But it can't make that non-resident student apply for admission, make it impossible for him to attain the best benefits of residency. In other words, the durational residency there has to be restricted. Now, there is no federal Supreme Court statement to the effect that you can only have a 2-year or a 1-year or a 6-month period. Future Supreme Court decisions might result in the establishment of that. That's not clear at present what it is. But the basic point is that it seems to me that Alaskans are looking at the issue backwards. They're trying to discriminate. They're intent on discriminating against outsiders. And that if this intent is manifest in state law, then those state laws are going to be struck down by the federal Supreme Court when they're challenged, because it's impermissible discrimination.
So the court's decision in the Zobel case seemed to indicate that one of the main problems with the law, the permanent fund distribution law, was that it created permanent fixed classes of citizens, and that was clearly impermissible. That someone who was born here in 1962, under that scheme, would receive less money than someone who moved here in 1961, and that those distinctions would remain in order to receive benefits. So the court had little problem in finding the Zobel argument to be valid, and that the state's law was unconstitutional. It's an important question now before the legislature as to what is the impact of the Zobel decision on other state programs which distribute benefits on the basis of residency. We've already seen a court challenge to the student loan program, another court challenge to the longevity bonus program, and I'm sure that the legislature and the governor are both trying to search for a way that will allow distribution of benefits and still remain in the Constitution. Barring an easy or quick solution to that dilemma, what do you think the impact of the Zobel decision will be in the short term on state programs which distribute benefits on the basis of residency?
Well, the short-term effect is to make all of these residency programs ambiguous and to make all of them potentially subject to legal challenge, and to make it difficult for the legislature to set up new programs that discriminate on the basis of years of residence in the state, and even, it seems to me, to continue funding of those in effect. And there are a large number of programs that fall into question here. You've mentioned longevity, but there's also the question of pioneer homes, which give substantial benefits to individuals who established a period of 15 years of continuous residency in the state. There are also questions related to land disposal and to land costs, so that it's much cheaper for me to buy land, and will always be cheaper for me to buy land than it would be for somebody who's just come into the state. And there's a question about whether that is protected. And student loan programs. There are also commercial fishery programs and the others. Now, the state administration and the task force of the Sheffield administration have looked at these carefully, but it's quite clear that since these are some of these are currently challenged in the courts and others will be challenged, that some other criterion is going to have to be used for distributing benefits than residency.
Thank you, Jerry. This has been Alaskan Legislative Review. I'm Scott Sterling, and today I've been talking with Dr. Gerald McBeth, Chair of the Political Science Department at the University of Alaska at Fairbanks. On this program, we covered residency, the legal and constitutional background of the residency issue. Next week, we'll be back with a discussion of the permanent fund. Alaskan Legislative Review is a production of radio station KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska at Fairbanks. Our executive producer is Carla Tanella. If you'd like a cassette copy of today's program, please write for information. The address is Alaskan Legislative Review, KUAC-FM, University of Alaska, Fairbanks, Alaska, 99701.